As she told this story to Wilson, she played on themes she knew would move his Texas spirit. She described how these primitive tribesmen would bow to Mecca in prayer 5 times a day. She emphasized how few weapons they had, and described how the Afghans treated their guns like library books. As soon as one warrior crossed the border, he would turn in his gun, handing it over to another man going off to face death. "It was so humbling," she went on. "Nothing ever affected me like seeing those 20,000 men raising their guns and shouting to fight to the last drop of their blood." When Joanne introduced Wilson to Fawcett, she was operating on the powerful conviction that they had 2 things in common, an impulse to stand up for the underdog, mixed with a thirst for glamour and adventure. Charles Fernley Fawcett is an immensely likable man, and, as Joanne had hoped, he immediately charmed Wilson with tales of non-stop swashbuckling, adventure, and good deeds. As Wilson learned, Fawcett had begun life as an orphan of sorts, watched over very loosely by an uncle from the well-heeled Fernley Fawcett family of South Carolina. By 15, Fawcett says, he had commenced an affair with his best friend's mother. "A wonderful woman," he recalled warmly. "If that's child molestation, I would wish this curse on every young boy." But this mother of his dreams cut off the relationship, and at 16, the handsome, powerful young man, already an all-state football player, escaped on a tramp steamer bound for the great fleshpots of the world. The young Fawcett was one of those gifted all-purpose talents. He had a commanding voice, a strong, beautiful body which he bared for sculptors, an artistic talent which made him a gifted sketcher, and a musical ear which allowed him to play the trumpet well enough to go backstage one night and get a few tips from Louis Armstrong. "What you do, my boy, is you pick up the trumpet thusly, and you put it to your lips thusly, and then you blow, boy, blow." One day, after watching a professional wrestling match, he went backstage and asked the wrestler to show him some moves. For the next year, he traveled through the back-alley theaters of Eastern Europe, playing the role of the honest American boy heroically fighting underhanded opponents. "It got to the point that I didn't care that the villain always pinned me," Fawcett remembers, "because I was clean and the others were dirty and the audience was always for me, so much so that they sometimes would storm the ring trying to get the other guy." Fawcett still has scrapbooks, news clippings, and book entries that document an otherwise unbelievable life. An ambulance driver in France at the outbreak of World War II, an RAF pilot during the Battle of Britain, scrambling to his Hurricane to take on Messerschmitts over London, and even a tour as a member of the French Foreign Legion. At the end of the war, Fawcett came down with tuberculosis and was discharged from the Legion. He was reduced to playing taps at funerals and digging up graves to identify Nazi victims, until an old friend rescued him with an offer of a bit part in a movie. Over the next 2 decades, Fawcett reinvented himself as an actor, appearing in over 100 B-grade movies, many of them in Italy. He was a star of sorts, but always cast in the role of the villain. He performed his own stunts, leaping out of buildings, brawling with Buster Crabb, and riding horses off cliffs. He may have been a second-tier player during the day, but at night, in the words of the gossip columnists, he was the King of Rome and the Mayor of Via Veneto. Warren Beatty remembers him as the centerpiece of the Dolce Vita of the city, loved and adored by everyone. It was there that Fawcett met Baron Ricky de Portanova, who would later marry Joanne's childhood friend, Buckets. At that time, de Portanova didn't advertise his title. He was penniless and relied on his deep voice to scratch out a living dubbing films into English. He and Fawcett shared a tiny apartment off the Via Veneto. Whoever had a woman for the night got the bed. The toilet was down the hall. Had it not been for Joanne Herring, de Portanova might have remained an impoverished and forgotten member of the Cullen Oil clan. His mother was a Cullen, but she was mentally impaired and had virtually no contact with her family or its fortune. Joanne convinced him to stand up for his rights and to sue for his share of the family fortune. He did, and he won, and by the 1970s had become a fixture in Houston's high society, the fabulously rich international jet-setter Baron de Portanova. He was so rich that he once talked of buying the famous 21 Club restaurant in New York as a birthday present for Buckets. Like many men who come into fortunes late in life, the Baron romanticized his penniless days in Rome with his old friends. 20 years later, alarmed to discover that Fawcett was in bad health and out of money, he insisted that his old roommate come to River Oaks to supervise the construction of his mansion's vast new swimming pool wing. Fawcett accepted the plane ticket and the appointments with Houston's best doctors, and moved in with the Baron and Baroness, quickly becoming a prominent, much-loved extra man in Houston's roaring 70s society. But he didn't feel right about living in this lap of luxury. To begin with, all was not well in the Baron's house. The year before, Deportanova's loyal valet had been shot and killed while carrying a platter of cold partridges into lunch. The Baron insisted that he, not the valet, had been the real target. There were suggestions of rival kinsmen resorting to shady means in an effort to fight the Baron's claim on the Cullen fortune. When the swimming pool wing burned to the ground, the Baron again suspected foul play. Fawcett was irrationally guilt-stricken, convinced that he somehow could have prevented it. But beyond that, Fawcett was restless, without a cause, and feeling decadent. When the Soviets invaded Afghanistan, the 60-year-old told Joanne Herring that he intended to leave Houston for the mountains of Afghanistan to pass on tactics he had learned in the Foreign Legion to the Afghan resistance. No amount of cajoling from the Baron and Baroness could change Fawcett's mind, so they gave in and threw him an elegant going-away dinner in the wine cellar of Houston's finest restaurant. Joanne Herring saw him off at the airport the next morning, and 6 months later, after receiving his scribbled note, she was in Afghanistan with a camera crew to help Fawcett rally the conscience of the world. Wilson was entranced by Fawcett, whom he considered a Renaissance romantic. "He loves beauty, he loves war, and he loves killing bad guys," Wilson remembered. As far as Wilson was concerned, Fawcett was a hero, an American who had killed fascists in Spain, shot down Messerschmitts over London, and had been in the Hindu Kush shooting Russians. How could I say no to a guy like that? But it was not so easy to be flattering about Fawcett's film. He had chosen Joanne to serve as his blonde interviewer and persuaded Orson Welles, an old friend from Via Veneto, to be the narrator. The Baron threw himself into promoting the effort with a lavish black-tie dinner for the Houston premiere. The setting he chose was the newly reconstructed wing of his mansion, built around a giant Grecian swimming pool with oversized chandeliers. As the lights went down, a lone Mujahid warrior was seen on the back of a rearing stallion. An Afghan with a great white beard bearing a startling resemblance to Fawcett ran up to the mounted horseman and asked, "Commander, where are you going?" In the background, music straight out of an Errol Flynn adventure rose up. "I'm going to fight the Russians," the Mujahid warrior growled. "But, Commander, how can you fight the infidel without weapons?" Onto the screen flashed the film's title, "Courage is Our Weapon." Joanne Herring watched with mixed reactions. "Fawcett just couldn't bear to cut any of it," she says. She acknowledges that the film is something less than sophisticated, particularly during her interviewing segments. "Here the Afghans were telling me how the Russians had stuck a bayonet into a pregnant woman's stomach, and I'm trying to understand their language and smiling, always smiling because I'm trying to encourage them to speak English." When the lights came on after the 2-hour documentary, the Baron tapped his champagne glass and stood to offer a toast. "This," he said, gesturing to his lavish swimming pool annex with the great chandeliers, "this is not reality." Pointing theatrically to the projector, Fawcett and Herring, he continued, "This movie, this is reality." Wilson was delighted to be included in the Baron's social circle. "I'd never met any of those people before," recalls Wilson. "It's the kind of fantasy world that every Texan has always heard about and found exciting." But Wilson, the great anti-communist, had to cope with the fact that Fawcett and Joanne had gone into the war zone. They had actually taken risks to do something about the communists. He didn't quite know what to say when Joanne insisted that the CIA was playing a fake game in Afghanistan, that the U.S. consul she had met at the frontier was a kind of apologist for the Russians, and that brave men were dying because of congressional neglect. It didn't matter that he had made a telephone call to double the covert aid budget for the Mujahideen. A few million dollars more was a meaningless gesture, she said. Joanne Herring wanted Wilson to become the Mujahideen's true champion. Wilson's manhood, she implied softly. was on the line.